we are surrounded by myriad forms of violence. And all of those violences are structural. They are there to keep the powerful, to keep the billionaires, to keep the corporates, to keep the, to keep the patriarchs in place.
Welcome to Shame Booth. This is our podcast. I'm Paula Williams, and that's the voice of Eve Ensler.
I think our job now is to find out how, in ridding that violence, we begin to shift the world in another direction.
Yeah. Eve Vagina Monologues Ensler. That's who. It was so cool to have her on the show and have a really deep conversation with her. And it's funny now, it seems like it was a lifetime ago when we did that interview. It was in early February, long before COVID really hit the States. And right now we're going into month two of sheltering in place. And I gotta be honest with you guys, I've been through the emotional ringer, probably like all of you, and have needed to hit the reset button and reassess. I got to some dark places and had some pretty bleak thoughts. I've had to stop listening to the news. But now I'm feeling a little bit better, seeing some light, and I'm back. We're back. Shame Booth is back. Because you know what? This is a crazy fucking time, and we don't know what's next. There's change and uncertainty. We have a new president hopefully coming up in the pipes if he doesn't drop dead. And, we love talking about hard stuff here at Shame Booth. The darker, the better. And we believe that sometimes working through the tough shit, talking about it, airing it out, you find some light and hope within that. And remembering, you know, we're just human. And be kind to yourself in this process. Okay, let's get to Eve. What a badass. She has done so much for women and victims of sexual violence across the globe. But, you know, she's most well known, of course, for the Vagina Monologues. We sat down with her to talk about her latest book, The Apology, written by her, channeling her father. It's an apology, one she never received from him, but wrote in his voice for the years of sexual and physical abuse he inflicted upon her. It's intense, really intense. And it's powerful and it's brutal, honest, and yeah, even healing. So right now, one of the biggest challenges we're dealing with as a society is abuse in the home. You know, kids aren't able to go to school and get away from their abusers, often their caregivers or their parents. And partners of domestic violence are stuck at home, and there's nowhere to go. There's no escape from the abuser. It's awful. And this is exactly what Eve felt as a kid. There was no escape. The apology isn't her escape, but it's her resolution. I spoke with Eve from her home in the woods in upstate New York. We spoke about her book, The Apology, Feminism, Genocide, and the Power of Calling Men In Instead of Calling Them Out. Yep. Have a listen.
I think where we are, I mean, look, I've been involved in the movement to end violence against all women for the last 22 years. It's a much longer movement than me. I mean, it goes back to 70 years, right? And then with the recent iteration of Me Too, we've been doing this a very long time, right? And we've been calling men out. We've been sharing our stories. We've been breaking the silence. We've been building shelters. We've been organizing hotlines. We've been, you know, doing everything. And yet we're still here. Mm-hmm. Unless men actually change, unless men actually do the work, and the work that I really outlined in the apology at that TED Talk, we are not going to move forward. And I think we have done the really important work of calling men out and saying, this is what you're doing. This is what you've done. This is what is happening. Now we've got to do the critical work of calling men in so they will do the work to change, right?
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any examples of that at all?
Well, I don't know that I'm seeing it publicly yet. But I will say, like, I am definitely getting letters from men. I got a letter today, an email today from a man who had had a problem with addiction and had been in his relationship with his wife. And during the height of his addiction, he had beaten his wife, had done really bad. And he said that he was absolutely horrified by it. He had heard the TED Talk. He was going to work with somebody to go through a process to make amends and go through the apology process so he could really change their relationship, because there was so much of that residue that was harming who they were together now. And I've been getting, definitely been getting letters like that. And I have to say, men have been very receptive to this book, whether they're readers or reviewers or that kind of thing. Do I think we've seen this cultural shift yet? No, I do not. I think we've seen Harvey Weinstein go down without a drop of remorse. We've seen Cosby in prison saying he will never have remorse. We've seen Russell Simmons not owning one part of anything that he's done, just to say that he was a womanizer, but not at all addressing any of the women who have claimed that he sexually abused them. We're not seeing a lot of men coming forward to take responsibility, who have shown that they've done deep self-interrogation, deep self-investigation, looking at their families, their childhood, the culture, what made them, and then doing a really deep, detailed accounting of their actions and what they've done to women, and then sitting with the suffering they've caused, feeling what their victims feel, feeling the impact, the long-term and short-term impact of what they've done, and then making amends. I don't think we've seen that, certainly not publicly. There may be men who are going through that process, you know, privately and internally, but on the public level, it has not shifted yet, no.
It's happening. It's going to happen.
Oh, it's definitely going to happen. It has to happen. And I think it just needs... We just need to kind of jar it a little. We need to push it a little. And we need to say, there is space for you to do this. There is an opportunity for you to do this. Come and go through a process that will not only free you of the guilt and the sorrow and the self-hatred that you're carrying from the acts that you've done, but also will change you into a much better kind of human being, you know?
I think there was something you wrote also about, as like a nation, the United States, it has never been able to look directly at, you know, the violence and the damage it's done to the Native people or the slavery in this country, and that we tend to just not look at it. But you said that if we can really look at it, if we can really see and own our part, that yes, it's going to be really tough, it's going to be really uncomfortable, it's going to be horrible, but that pain and suffering is going to be so limited to the freedom that we get when we get to the other side of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think we can move forward unless we clean up the past. It's impossible. And I actually think that the current state we're in, this current predator in chief, evolved out of a history of unreckoned landfill. Like, we are sitting on unreckoned landfill, right? We have never dealt with the fact that this land that we stand on was not our land. It was indigenous people's land. We stole that land. We created genocide in order to get that land, moving towards African Americans who were bought here as slaves and were held in slavery and confinement and degradation for hundreds of years, which led to Jim Crow, which led to more dehumanization and more white supremacy. And like, that is our legacy. That is our history. And we are swimming in that. And unless we own it, unless we do all the things I just suggested, which is interrogate it, look at our role in it, look at our connection to it. Where are we like that? What remnants do we have in ourselves? How are we perpetuating it by not being anti-racist, by not being for indigenous people's rights, by not looking about the suffering that is today? We will continue to have these kind of karmic outcomes that reflect in the current leadership of this country. And I think, as I've always said about this current president in chief, this predator in chief, he is what we haven't dealt with, right? He is the shame, he is the horror, he is the self-hatred, he is the guilt, he is the mendacity of what we haven't dealt with.
Yeah, we created him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Could you just share What was your childhood like? I mean, we don't have time to get into all of it. I wish we
did.
Well,
I think I'll talk about it in terms of the book, The Apology, which, you know, just came out in May. I mean, the book was really an attempt. I had waited for many years for an apology from my father for the incredible, the devastating sexual abuse and the incredible violence, physical violence he had inflicted upon me. And of course, I did not get that. But you never stop waiting for an apology. You're always yearning for it someplace, any survivor of any kind of horrible aggression or violence. And then I was looking at the current situation and noticing how many men in recent last few years have been called out who had not made amends, had not apologized, had not dealt with, had not self-interrogated. So I decided to write a letter from my father to me, basically apologizing and saying all the things to me that I longed for and the words I needed to hear and the explanations. And basically, my childhood was a childhood that was very, very, very painful. My father began sexually abusing me when I was 5. Until I was 10. And then when he stopped that, he began to physically abuse me, almost murdering me twice. So I grew up in this kind of, I grew up in a realm of violence. I was an outcome of violence. I'm a consequence of violence. And I think so much of my life has been about how do we end violence? You know, I've worked for many, many years in a movement, V-Day, to end violence against women, all women and girls. I've devoted my life to, you know, climate activism and working for homeless people and immigration reform and working women and just all the violence that, or the forms of violence that exist in this country, whether it's racism, whether it's colonialism, whether it's imperialism, whether it's wars, whether it's like, we are surrounded by myriad forms of violence. And all of those violences are structural. They are there to keep the powerful, to keep the billionaires, to keep the corporates, to keep the, to keep the patriarchs in place. And I think our job now is to find out how, in ridding that violence, we begin to shift the world in another direction. I grew up in the 50s. Like, people were not talking about that then. And you know what I mean? First of all, you didn't question your father, right? And that just wasn't happening then. This was before women's liberation. This was before anybody ever thought that a father could be wrong. So, patriarchy was at an all-time peak then, right? I mean, those were the days when men did whatever they wanted, where women were completely controlled and weren't able to speak out, weren't able to be independent, weren't able to have equal pay for equal work, weren't even able to work, weren't in control of their bodies, weren't in control of their sexuality, didn't even know they had a right to orgasm. I mean, we can go down the list. You know, patriarchy is a virus. It lies dormant and it waits until the conditions are ripe and then it bursts out again. I mean, it never officially goes away. And I think, the longer I'm alive, I think when you're younger, you kind of have a little bit of naivete and you believe, my God, we can work and we can struggle and we can really end this patriarchy. And it's not that I don't believe that deep in my heart, but I see how ferocious it is. I see how it will not let go. It's programmed into the DNA of both men and women, you know, where women actually end up voting against their best interests, right? So it is a struggle.
Well, I feel like now, especially when, you know, Trump became elected, for me as well, I mean, I was busy. I was a stay-at-home mom. I was a homemaker. I was drinking and using and self-harm and all that stuff. So as soon as I realized, holy shit, I got to wake up. I have to start paying attention and not let other people make decisions for me. And to raise 3 daughters in this culture was to, like, wake up, do the work, start healing my own trauma, give my shame back to whoever gave it to me that's not mine to carry, and then I can be awake and more present so I can help my community.
Yep.
Now that I'm awake, it's there are times where it is really daunting. So how do you get up every day and try not to let all this shit that's happening, really keep you from going back to bed and just saying, I give up?
Well, you know, I have days when I'm, you know, really, really frustrated, and I feel despair. But I also, like, I'm very fortunate that I'm part of a global movement called V-Day and a global campaign called 1 Billion Rising. And so my life is very deeply connected to women across the world who are struggling to end various forms of violence. And my life is intertwined with theirs. And so that solidarity, that movement, that ongoing work, that ongoing energy that we're creating together is it keeps my hope alive. Like if I look at what we've done, for example, in the Congo with the director of City of Joy, Christine Schuler-Describer, and we opened 9 years ago this amazing sanctuary and revolutionary center for women who had been massively abused during the war, you know, sexually abused. And in 9 years, we've graduated, you know, I think close to 1,500 women who are now leaders in their community. They've gone from being victims to survivors to leaders. We were able to provide them each 6 months of training, of healing, of knowing themselves, of therapy, whether it be group therapy or dance or learning their rights or becoming better at agriculture. So I feel like if I just look at that one project, but then we've got projects all over the world, and then 1 Billion Rising exists in 180 countries where women every year are rising and dancing in their communities to end these various forms of violence. So I feel so much energy, and I feel so regenerated constantly by being connected to that movement. And I will say, I think movements enliven people. You begin to see your place in the collective. You begin to rise up in the collective. I think one of the things I've been so moved by around Bernie Sanders is just to see this movement that's emerged with him, around him, pushing him, informing him, lifting him, that it's young people, it's older people, it's Black people, it's brown people, it's Asian people, it's, you know, nurses, it's Walmart workers. It's very inspiring just to be in that mix, to feel like you're part of a story that is trying to change the current paradigm. And I think all of us need to think, like, how do we get connected to movements? How do we enlarge those movements? How do we spread those movements so those movements can have impact, not only on our politicians, but on our communities in shifting the way we're living our lives? It's like, if you get involved in your community, for example, in starting 1 Billion Rising or starting a V-Day or starting whatever it is that you want to be involved with, that you're involved with a group, that begins to keep you going. That begins to be what sustains you. That gives you energy. Do you know what I mean? And I think none of us can do this alone. You look, I've been sober a long time too. And no, I could not do anything before I put down, before I stopped drinking. There's no way. And I feel like because I was self-harming and I was destroying myself and I wasn't here. I wasn't present. But I also think like that what so much of kind of neoliberal capitalism has done is atomized us and separated us and isolated us and turned us into these individualized consuming machines, right? Who are either consuming or hating ourselves because we're not as pretty, as rich, as famous, as blah, 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 as we're supposed to be, right? But what happens when you get involved in groups and you start working in groups and you start working for something that you, a mission that you all have in common, you know, a goal, a vision, then you start to find meaning on a whole different level. And it isn't a transactional meaning. It's a connective meaning. It's a relational meaning. It's a meaning about improving your life, but also improving the lives of other people, which to me it gives one the deepest satisfaction. You know, getting out of your own comfort zone, you know, reaching out so that you care as much about the homeless people in this country and the people who are in poverty and the people who are struggling for one fair wage as you do about the people, if you're middle class, who are in your own community. Like, we are responsible for each other. And we are responsible for each other rising and each other having healthcare and each other not having to be burdened with student debts and, you know, all those things. And so how do we get involved in that struggle in a way where we get out of our own, to be honest, like, I think a lot of people are just like, why don't I have this? Why don't I have that? Why? And I think the answer is, go out and find the people who are struggling in a much more profound way than you're struggling, right? And be of service and find out and listen and find out how you can make their lives better and what they need. And I'm telling you, that's when you begin to feel better, and that's when your anxiety goes away, and that's when your self-hatred goes away. You know, when you give what you need the most, you heal the broken part inside.
I so agree. And I mean, we're so much more similar than we are different. And you did a City Arts and Lecture here in San Francisco, and I think your book had just come out, and they played a clip of an actor reading a portion of the book. I had never heard anything like it, and it was so powerful, and I just pulled over and sobbed thinking about, you know, like, we want that apology. And do you feel like you got what you needed?
You know, it's funny because since the book came out, I've had the privilege and honor to, I've just gone to a tour to a bunch of countries. So I've heard the book read now in India. I've heard it read in Taiwan. I've heard it read in France, in Italy, and, you know, and it's been the exact same thing. Women just sit there and sob, you know, and I'm excited to say there's going to be a theatrical version of it coming up. For me, the book was incredibly transformative and healing. And I will say that, granted, it was a conjuring. It was my imagination that did it. It was my ability to, you know, transform and turn things around inside myself and inside my father. But, you know, it was odd. You know, my father's been dead 31 years. And yet when I wrote the book, I felt him so present through the whole writing of it. And I felt that he was there, and I felt in some ways he was writing it with me. And when I finished, there's the last line of the book is, "Old man, be gone." I felt, I didn't know who said it, he or I, but I completely felt him go shoop into the ethers. And he hasn't been back. Whatever that paradigm was, whatever that relationship was of me proving to my father that I wasn't the horrible, terrible, you know, thing that he thought I was, or every victory was proof that he was wrong, or, you know, just my rage, and it's over. Like, I'm not in that story anymore. As a matter of fact, I really don't think about him at all anymore. And it's been both exciting and daunting because so much of my life, the motor of my life, was built on that. And so I really, since May, been really redefining the next stage of my life and you know, why am I here, right? So much was to prove to him that I had a right to be here, right? And I don't have to do that anymore. So yes, it had a profound and strong healing effect.
How do you protect yourself from, you know, I'm sure so many people want to share their experience or their trauma with you. How do you handle that? Is it hard for you to sit and to listen?
Well, I have to say, for many years, I listened to every story that anyone shared with me. And it was a privilege and it was an honor. And every story that I heard, I just feel so moved and so, you know, profoundly touched that women would trust me to share their stories. But about 10 years ago, I got very, very sick with uterine cancer, and I almost died. But I realized at that point I couldn't really listen to stories anymore. Like, I had to stop. And so I don't really go into in-depth stories anymore, but I've signed up. I'm here to, you know, fight to end violence against women until I die. And so, you know, and I think if you are listening to stories and if you are in the front lines, you should do a lot of work to take care of your body. You should do regular massages, body work, dancing, screaming, purging, and be very careful, because women we're porous creatures. We're very compassionate. We're empathetic. Things go into us, and we have to be careful how we clear them as they're coming into us. That's not to say we shouldn't listen, but we've also got to be careful what we take in and how we process what we take in.
During your TED Talk, you know, when we call, instead of calling men out, we're calling them in, you were very clear about how specific an apology must be. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes, I think one of the things I learned during this book is that an apology is really a sacred commitment. It is, you know, we teach our children how to pray, right? But we don't teach them how to apologize. You know, I'm sorry isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a real process that I think is like four-stepped. The first step is really deep self-interrogation and self-reflection. Who am I? How did I get to be a person who could have done what I've done? What was my childhood upbringing? What was my cultural indoctrination? What went into the ingredients that made me me? Then the second part is, what did I actually do? And a detailed accounting, not, I'm sorry if I hurt you or I'm sorry if I sexually abused you. It's, I literally came into your room in the middle of the night. I pulled back your covers. I pulled your underpants down. I did it. And being very specific, because really the liberation is in the details. It's when you say the specifics of what you've done that you free both your victim and yourself. And then I think the third part is really, what were the impacts, sitting with the impact of the consequences of what you've done, feeling what your victim felt, sitting with the suffering you've caused? What did my victim feel when I entered her without asking permission? What did she feel when I threw her head, beat her head against the wall? What went through her? How did that make her feel for the rest of her life about men and intimacy and touch and really doing a deep investigation? And then the last piece, of course, is making an amends. And if you have done all those other steps, it would indicate that you have changed and you weren't capable of doing that again. And I think that is the kind of process we have to make happen in order for people to really transform this paradigm that we are in at this time.
And do you think that there will be? I know you said you've gotten some letters from men. Weinstein, you know, he's never going to admit, you know, what he did. But then there are people, you know, men living their lives. They're not in a position of great power, like we see people being called out. But do you think there'll be spaces created either by men or survivors who are going to kind of facilitate this type of experience to show men how to do it?
Well, that's my dream. That's why I wrote the book. And I'm hoping it will lead to that. And I'm hoping it will. I've already heard that men are using the book in groups to work on their past actions. I'm hoping that we can start creating more groups where men come and feel safe and feel prepared and ready to address their past actions or their current actions, depending on who they are. That would be, I do believe that restorative justice is the only path forward, that there are very few men on this planet who haven't done something in regards to a woman that they're not ashamed of. And I think we now have to create a pathway for transformation and wholeness. Because I didn't have someone there to help me through it at the beginning, you know, I went astray. Right? I went to drugs. I went to alcohol. I went to promiscuity. I had no value for my body because my value had been so devalued, right? I had no choice over my body because I'd never been given a choice. And, you know, looking back, I left my body at a very young age and I didn't come back until much later in life. And that had enormous consequence, you know? And I just want to say to anybody who's been beaten or been raped or incested or harassed or sexually abused, reach out right away. Don't wait for years. The sooner you address it, the sooner you deal with it, the more hope there is for the transformation of it and turning that poison into medicine. And the longer you wait, the more it metastasizes and eats away at your body. and eats away at your self-esteem and eats away at your ability to function. So, you know, there are so many places now that you can go, and we are in a very different place than when I grew up. You know, no one talked about it. No one knew about it. No one heard about it. There was no one to talk to. Now we know it's a front page issue. We are here. It's a new landscape. So don't wait. It's not your shame. It's not your fault. You didn't create it, and go and address it wherever you can.
Oh my God, Eve Ensler. So, so cool to have a conversation with you. Thank you so much. You are speaking our language. What an inspiration you are to so many of us. So if you haven't got her book, go to a bookstore and pick it up. Or you can't go to a bookstore right now, but there's thebookshop.org. Buy her book there. It supports local bookstores. The Apology. Read it, share it with others. Check out her website, eveensler.org. See her plays, read her articles, become activated. Turn shame, abuse, suffering into your superpower, just as Eve has. If there's ever a time we all need to be getting a superpower, it'd be like yesterday. And speaking about superpowers, the people that are brave enough to walk into the booth, they dig deep for theirs. And they share some things that are so powerful and honest. Have a listen.
I almost don't know where to start because I feel like I feel ashamed about like my whole life. In the sense that like I let so many people in my life tell me what to do because I trust them and I trust that they know what's best for me when I should have just trusted myself the whole time. You know, not majoring in what I wanted to major in college and not pursuing my dreams and not trusting my intuition when I was 19 and now I'm 29 and I feel stuck in a life that doesn't feel belongs to me. And I don't even know where to start to make it better. I guess here. I am trying to take steps to better myself in terms of going to therapy and finally saving money and, you know, doing things on the side that make me feel happy and trying to unstuck myself. But definitely, like, my huge identity crisis that I've felt like my whole life and other people telling me this is what's good for you, you should do this, and never listening to myself and just, you know, I ended up even dropping out of college. I didn't even graduate, and I never correct people because I feel so ashamed that I didn't even graduate. And I'm an immigrant, and my family, like, moved here, and we were undocumented for 15 years, and I couldn't even graduate college for them, you know. And now I'm living this life that I hate, and I'm broke. And they're not proud of me, and I'm not proud of me, and just all that shame. And I heard someone say today that what they would tell their younger selves is, you know, you love yourself and that's okay. And I'm learning to love myself and I'm learning to believe that that's okay. And maybe one day it'll feel real. Thank you for this. It feels good to let that go.
My goodness, where would I start with the shame I needed this booth decades ago? You know, the biggest shame, the biggest not good enough was from the abuse, the neglect that I experienced as a little girl. I was sexually abused by my father and by an uncle. And those memories have just actually come back to me in the last few years, and I'm working through those, but coming into the awareness that I internalized so much of that shame and felt so broken and so wounded around those events, rather than really understanding that these were things that were done to me. Evil, awful, painful, cruel. Things that were done to me, rather than a mark of something that I did wrong. And it's so important for me to talk about it to bring it out of the dark to the surface and to just move it away from my inner being and to acknowledge that this is not of me. It was something that was done to me, and there's no reason for me to feel wrong, to feel dirty, to feel broken because these things happen to me. And the more I get to talk about it, the more I get to set it down. And so I'm grateful for this space somewhere in the ether to be able to unload that heaviness, and little by little, the shame lessens, and the more that I get to be my beautiful, magical, wonderful self.
So I was the victim of abuse when I was younger, sexual abuse, and I've never talked about it. And I actually have been ashamed because there wasn't that much difference in age between me and my abuser. And for years, I felt like I was somehow a part of it, even though I didn't want it. I felt that I was somehow to blame for it, that I had encouraged it, and it's something that I've been ashamed of addressing and working through. And it affects everything in my personal life, my intimate life, my sexual life, and this is the first step in acknowledging that it happened and it existed. And I just want to release the shame.
Wow. You know, these clips move me every time. I've heard them often, but they still have an impact on me. And that's pretty incredible. So thank you to all those brave people that trust us to share their shame. And guys, as we say on every goddamn show, you don't need the booth. And it's going to be a while probably before we can get the booth out into the world. But how about a phone? You got a phone? Do you have a phone? Get a phone. Get a fucking phone and call the shame line right now. It's a very hard time. We know that. Even if you're stuck in a house with a bunch of people, your family, you can still feel lonely or isolated. And if you're alone and isolated, well, we're here for you too. You have a place to let go of your feelings, to let go of all that shame. Call the shame line. And please, share this with others. 888-SHAME-LINE. Call any time. It's there for you. And you don't need this 6 feet away of social distancing bullshit to do it either. It's just you, your shame, and the phone. Okay, guys, we're in a crazy time, of course. It's a nutty world, but be safe. Be kind to yourself and your neighbors. Trust that this too shall pass. I want to believe that there's something better down the road. I'm going to hold on to that. And please, take care of yourself. My name is Paula Williams, and this is Shame Booth, a podcast series about getting proud. To learn more, please go to shamebooth.org, sign up for our newsletter, follow us on Instagram, and get your Shame Booth on and your shame out. Shame Booth, the podcast, is produced by Sound Made Public with Tanya Katanjian and Philip Wood and Katie McCutcheon. And Shame Booth, the team, is me, Paula Williams, Retta Roland, and our lovely Shame Dames that will be right out there as soon as it's safe, that will represent at our events all over the country. We thank you. Be safe, be well, free your shame, know you're not alone, and know that we are here. Next episode, Nadia Bowles-Weber, a Lutheran minister, and like any other.